Jason, we friends just having a conversation.
Wave your hands, hands high.
Don't stop.
Wave your hands, hands high.
Don't stop.
All right, welcome back to North Texas Music Fanatics. I'm Jason Janik. I am super excited about this episode. I used to see this person play down at Trees and absolutely fell in love with the photos that I would take of her on stage. So let's hear from Beth Clardy Lewis.
Hi, thank you. That was nice. I like that intro.
Well, you're welcome. All right, so let's discuss what got you into music. You had two bands here in Dallas. Both were very well regarded. Tell us a little bit about it.
Getting into music, that's a big question with a probably meandering answer, but I'll try to keep it simple. I was raised around music with my dad plays a mean piano completely by ear, and my mom was constantly singing, and I was raised in musical theater and raised in the church choir and all of that good stuff. Loved every bit of it. And then when I went, my family moved from Kansas to Texas, and when we moved to Texas, we were in this small tiny town, Commerce, Texas. And in Commerce, believe it or not, in their tiny little public school system, they had no choir or no music in their school except for like marching band, which I wasn't interested in. So instead of pursuing and continuing with choirs, I wrecked my vocal cords by becoming a cheerleader for 4 years, which I just kind of acclimated. That's what the kids were doing in Commerce, Texas, football and cheerleading. So I jumped in and ruined my vocal cords. Graduated from there, tried to pursue music again in college, my first go round in college, and bombed because my vocal cords were raw and butchered, and ultimately dropped out of college my first go round and dove into the Deep Ellum music scene and met Earl Harvin. And that was the rest kind of went into Rubber Bullet after that.
Well, that's pretty crazy because first of all, I mean, you don't really think about, except for Ben Queller, I mean, what else is there out in Commerce? But number two is I was refamiliarizing myself with your music. And while listening to both of the Pinkston albums, I guess one's a full LP and one's an EP, I was sitting back and I was like, there's so much flexibility and range in her voice. I'm surprised to hear you say that your voice is trash, because I listen to it and I'm like, I hear bits of Billie Holiday, I hear bits of Sheryl Crow, I hear bits of, you know, Tanya Donnelly. There's some voice there. So if that's your wrecked voice.
Well, and I think that by the time Pinkston got around, that was, I would have to honestly look at the CD covers to see what years those were. But that was well after. So when I wrecked my vocal cords, I was about 18, 19, 20. And when I met Earl, I think I was about 23, so I was on the mend. But by the time I met Earl, I was really busy smoking like clove cigarettes and dumb shit like that. So I never really took great care of my vocal cords, but I actively jacked them up when I was a cheerleader.
All right. Well, I mean, you mentioned Earl, which I mean that's a name you can say here in Dallas, and people will go nuts over.
Yeah, Earl Harvin.
He's
the god.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So. How does that happen?
Man, you know, he and I met at a friend's house. Well, actually, it was Aaron Berlin, who also was in Rubber Bullet. Aaron's girlfriend, I believe at the time, threw a party. And Earl was there, and I was there. And we were just kind of chatting, as you do in these gatherings. And Earl and I ended up sitting kind of near each other on a sofa. And he sparked up a conversation. He mentioned how he wanted to, and Earl Harvin, those of you who don't know, I don't know who doesn't know, but Earl was so known for his jazz trio, and that jazz trio was highly acclaimed and highly regarded, and Earl was a hotshot in the jazz world, and he wanted to come into the kind of the punk rock scene or the rock scene that Deep Ellum was really thriving with, and wanted to start a band that was not jazz, and he wanted to get out of his jazz identifier and really break into something that was new for him as well. And we were having this conversation, and I said, funny, I've always wanted to study opera. And I wish I could become an opera singer while he was trying to get out of jazz. I was wanting to get into opera. And we kind of just shot the shit and did like you do at that time. time, which was exchange phone numbers, like wrote it down on a piece of paper kind of thing. And he contacted me. I think this is how the memory goes. At least this is my memory of it. Don't go fact checking too much. But he contacted me a couple of days later, I feel, and asked if I wanted to get together to try out some music and see if we would work as a, if I would work as a vocalist. But he was also going to work with Kim Pendleton. He had Kim Pendleton lined up. And I was in awe of Kim Pendleton. Kim Pendleton still, if she walked in, I'd probably shake a little and become a really nervous, like, schoolgirl.
But yeah, she's got, because I photographed her a number of times over the years, and she's got this stage presence.
She's amazing. She's gorgeous. She's talented. Her voice is like no other. And she's just beautiful. From head to toe, she's just artist and musician, and I loved that about her. And he said, yeah, I've got Kim Pendleton lined up. Do you want to see? Maybe I'll have two female vocalists. And I got all wrapped up inside out in my guts of wanting to lose my nerve and tell him no, there's no way I could stand next to Kim Pendleton and even try. But we did. We threw down a little audition of sorts in his tiny little house on Greenville Avenue, and which I don't think is there anymore. I've driven by it a couple times. I don't think it's there anymore. Kim ultimately ended up going with or staying with Vibralux, and he grabbed me and let me be their vocalist.
Well, that's great. So Rubber Bullet, I know I've got their 7-inch. I know we've got the CD. Kind of tell me the life of Rubber Bullet. What all was put out? Where were they playing? That kind of stuff.
Rubber Bullet started rehearsing with, it was me, Earl Harvin, Richard Paul, Aaron Berlin, and Jonathan Mulkey. What was Jonathan Mulkey in? I'm really having to reach for that one. Anyway, it was the five of us, and we rehearsed in Aaron Berlin's warehouse in Oak Cliff. And at the time, Oak Cliff was not the cool place to be, but we had.
And this is around what, like 93?
Yeah, 93. Yeah, probably 93, 94. Yeah, right around then. And we rehearsed there. And the funny thing about Rubber Bullet is that we were kind of full of ourselves and proud of ourselves. And we, thanks to Aaron, who still works in the wine industry, we would have band rehearsals and drink really good wine. It was like a wine tasting meets band rehearsal. And we just wrote. It was Earl who would write stuff and Aaron. We would flush it out in rehearsal. And I would just kind of sing over it, which one time a friend jokingly said, does Rubber Bullet not know how to write choruses? Like, you, there are no choruses in your songs. And there's some truth to that. I didn't know what I was as a songwriter. And we just kind of fleshed things out and did it live, a little wine drunk. And I think we wrote some really creative pieces of art. I feel like with Rubber Bullet, when you listen to Rubber Bullet and you listen to Pinkston, Pinkston has some really strong song structure, and Rubber Bullet to me feels like paintings on a canvas. Like, I feel like it's just kind of this smattering of art that shows up on a CD, in a CD in musical form.
If you look at, I think around that same time we had Baboon forming, very much art rock. I mean, you can even go out nationally and you can say stuff like Jane's Addiction, but there was stuff out there.
Right. And we played a handful of times with the band. I think they're from Austin. You all know them better than I do, but they will know us by our Trail of Dead.
Oh, yeah.
And Trail of Dead, we played with them a handful of times. And I hated playing with them because they would just destroy shit. And they would ask to use our gear, and then they would destroy it. They're just little pompous fuckers. But but they fit in that genre you're describing. You know, they were also doing what we were doing, which was just kind of creating art and flipping the bird to anything that was structured or pop ready or radio friendly. We just kind of wanted to play all the club clear views of the country.
It's so crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is beautiful.
Yes.
I support that for sure.
Well, I think it would be fun to hear a little bit of Rubber Bullet. So why don't we do that right now?
All right.
Just
think it would be fun to discuss your next project. I mean, is there a story behind how Rubber Bullet kind of ended, or does it transition into something natural for Pinkston starting? Talk about that.
I think that's another pull at my memory. I believe that Rubber Bullet was coming to an end. I got married and started Pinkston, though Pinkston, timeline. Rubber Bullet was, I believe if I'm correct, Earl was touring a lot with his jazz. Oh no, it might have been when he was with Seal. Actually, he played with Seal for a while and was touring with Seal. Maybe it That's was right. even
yeah, the, I, the. I think I remember Max Hartman mentioning something about mm-hmm. that. I had forgotten all about that.
Yeah, yeah, he played with Seal, and he was just touring a lot on this big, big scale, and that was wonderful, and not one of us in Rubber Bullet was mad about that. We of course, were thrilled that he was getting those opportunities and being given those opportunities and earned those opportunities, but that put Rubber Bullet kind of on the back burner, and I was at a place where I just really wanted to be making music, and so I kind of started going towards Pinkston and creating Pinkston while Rubber Bullet was still intact. And I do not remember a last show of Rubber Bullets, or I just don't. I don't know. I don't remember the ending of it. I just remember the beginning of Pinkston. So that is my cop-out of the answer on that.
No, if that's an accurate answer, that's a great answer. Because I mean, that happens sometimes with mm-hmm. relationships, with bands, with it's part of life. So if it just kind of slowly disappeared.
That's how it felt to me. You might, you know, get different answers from the other band members, but to me, it felt like that's what happened. And Earl and I are still, you know, we still exchange messages through social media, and he's living in Germany. And so, and we've communicated a little bit here and there lately, which thrills me because I will always hold him in such high regard and dear regard. But Pinkston started with Josh Doherty, who was in a band called Earl at that time, and myself. He and I got together and started deciding to form this band. And he's such a great guitarist and a strong songwriter. And I didn't have an instrument except my voice. So that's hard to write music when you just have a voice. And back then, we didn't have the gear. So, I mean, I had a manual little tape recorder that I would push record on and kind of give him little cassettes. And we would he and I just wrote music like that in my bedroom and started getting other musicians to join us. Yeah. And that was, and then we had, let's see, Pinkston was myself, Josh Doherty, Ian Parsons, who was in a band called Record Player. And then for a while, and those two were guitarists. I was obviously on vocals. And then we hired a bass player, which at one point was Bart from Baboon, and then Chad Diatley from Baboon. Don't know the order of those two.
Chad from Dusu.
I'm sorry, Dusu. Dusu. And then we had Ben Burt on drums from Brutal Juice. And I decided I didn't want a five-piece like Rubber Bullet was, because I wanted to tour and do all these things. And when Rubber Bullet toured, which we did a lot of, it was crowded in our little van. So I decided to learn to play bass guitar and picked it up for Pinkston. I will get asked, do you still play bass? I'm like, no, I know like 10 songs and they're all Pinkston songs. I just learned to play.
See, I did not know that.
Yeah,
I always assumed that you had a passion for bass, and that's what pulled you in, because especially listening to the first Pinkston album, it is driven by the bass.
Yeah.
It's like you're taking the lead and Ben is following you, which is, I think, allows the album to have a very forward movement, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
It does. And that's good songwriting. And that was Josh Doherty. Josh wrote the bass lines and taught me how to play bass and trusted me with it, and which was huge, because I'm sitting in the middle of this rehearsal space with these strong musicians. You've got Josh and Ian and Ben, and they're looking at me and saying, you can do it. That's powerful. That's huge. That's a big responsibility, but one that I took took on and just thought, wow, if they're looking at me and thinking I can do it, then I can do it. And that was, and it made for a pretty cool thing. Josh swears to me that I am the bass player on all of the Pinkston tracks. And I kept asking him, I'm like, are you sure you don't go in and record over me once I'm gone? He was like, I swear that's you, Beth.
Well, so. Whoever's on that is powerful and is amazing, because I was listening to it on the way over here, and I just remember thinking, you know, this bass line is, it's so powerful.
Yeah.
And it makes a lot more sense. If I listen back through this now knowing that, I'd have to wonder, okay, well, did Josh write this to be a little more simple and straightforward so that you could carry it and the vocals at the same time?
Yeah.
But that's what makes it beautiful, is that, you know, I'm sitting here listening and it's like an attack and a drone at the same time. It's not too crazy.
It's really cool. And I love that you have that analysis of it, because it was really cool experience, Pinkston, because Pinkston is when I started really singing. Rubber Bullet was this awesome outlet for what was going on in my life at that time, which was a ton of heartache through the loss of a very best friend. I lost her to drug use. And not that that's what Rubber Bullet was created for. Earl didn't know that. I didn't know I was going to use it for that. But it was this really awesome platform to not only create the art that I was talking about, that Rubber Bullet was, but it was also this outlet for me to put my heartache and my sadness and my drama and my anger. And I got to transform all of those feelings through my vocals. And so they were raunchy sometimes, and they were rough sometimes, and they were off key sometimes, and they were perfect sometimes. But Pinkston showed up and allowed me this really cool platform of pretty. And I got to do pretty vocals and stronger vocals. And it's so reflective of where I was in my life at that time. Rubber Bullet's vocals 100% reflect who I was and where I was and what I was feeling. And same with Pinkston. Pinkston's vocals were steady and grounded and supported and pretty, which is where I felt I was at that time too.
Well, so I played the two Pinkston records back to back, and I noticed a definite progression and change between those two.
Yeah.
I mean, did you have like a conscious idea that you were going to push yourself further? When I listened to those albums, I hear a lot of what was going on at the time, because you can hear some That Dog, you can hear a little bit of Luscious Jackson, minus, you know, the way they use samples. Mm-hmm. You can hear a lot of the kind of girl riot that was developing up on the West Coast. But there's so many more influences in Pinkston.
Do you feel like when you listen to that, because I think you're referring to the Pinkston EP and then the Pinkston full length?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I feel like, while you're saying that, I feel like the Pinkston EP, which was the first thing we recorded, I feel like that was transitional from Rubber Bullet to Pinkston.
Oh, okay.
I feel like there's, you know, a little bit of Rubber Bullet still in my psyche.
That makes a lot of sense, because the EP touches a little more on, there's a little bit of jazz influence, there's a little bit more pop influence.
Right.
And then when you get to the LP, it's much more of what people like Toadies were doing, what people like Baboon were doing, Slow Roosevelt. There's a harder edge to it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And Pinkston lyrically was stronger. There was maturity in Pinkston, and there was a different life I was leading in Pinkston. Like I mentioned earlier, I was dating and then got married during the life of Pinkston. And actually my last show with Pinkston, I do remember a final show with Pinkston. The last show I played with Pinkston, I was 4 months pregnant. So it was I feel lucky, or I think it's cool. The way I look at it is that the little small record collection of which I'm a part, it really was my young adult life into becoming an adult. And there's a cool little timeline through these songs, and it's fun, for lack of a better word, to listen to. Sometimes it's hard to listen to, because they're active, recorded chapters of a diary.
Yeah.
And that can be comfortable and uncomfortable.
Sure. So who all did Pinkston play with, and where were you playing?
Pinkston played, we played a lot with the Toadies. That got married to Todd Lewis of the Toadies back in 98. We did play with the Toadies. We played with And this is, I get confused sometimes with my memory. 30 years ago, please remember that, 30-ish years ago, I get confused with Rubber Bullet and Pinkston. I know Rubber Bullet toured a ton with Baboon. We went up and down the East Coast a couple of times, if not more than twice, with Baboon. And played with Brutal Juice and played with the Toadies and played with, gosh, so many of that scene at that time. And Pinkston, gosh, who were we playing with? I'm at a loss.
I've got a picture of the Trees Marquee. I can't remember if you were playing the night before Adventures of the Jet or if you were playing with them.
Yeah, we did play with Jet, yeah.
Yeah, but I know the scene that I remember, you were playing with like AOJ, you were playing with people like Chomsky, you're still playing with people like Baboon, Slow Roosevelt was still performing some.
Mm-hmm.
All that was down there and you were part of it.
Chomsky, yes. And yeah, that was going on. And I appreciate your recollection of that because, man, my brain just totally went blank on that Pinkston chapter and where we were playing and doing. We were both, Rubber Bullet and Pinkston, both were supported and on the label Last Beat Records. They were such a strong record label in Deep Ellum at that time. And you're going to hear my cat in this. he's hanging out. That's Jack the Orange Cat. He's very vociferous. Yeah.
He's a thin cat.
He's thin.
My cat is so fat.
Oh, my God. I have another one, and he's upstairs sleeping. That's Preston. But Jack is an orange cat, which I learned after having him, that they're very known for their large vocabulary.
We're changing the show from North Texas Music Fanatics to North Texas Music and Cat Fanatics.
And Cat Fanatics. That cat is my... I love him. He's my sidekick for sure. We have lots of meaningful conversations on the regular.
All right, well, why don't we hear some Pinkston?
Let's do it.
I was thinking to myself, what song should be played? And every single song I came to, I was like, this has to be it.
You're so kind. I love that.
It's beautiful. It's one of those things that I wish we could play the whole album.
Yeah.
But let's go ahead and pick something, and hopefully y'all enjoy.
Strength in this land. I believe the world's on its turn.
So let's hear a little bit more about the scene when you were down there. You were down there through the 90s, mm-hmm. and it was quite active.
It was. It was quite a scene in the 90s. I'm very proud to have been part of that chapter of Deep Ellum. And I'm not sure, because once I was there, I was saturated in it, I was all the way in, and then when I left, I left and went in a different direction. So I don't know if that chapter continued for much longer after the 90s. I don't feel like it did. I feel like it was kind of a special time, the 90s in Deep Ellum. And today when you say Deep Ellum, people get this frazzled look like it was some hostile, violent place. And I don't know, was it? Is it? I don't even know. I just know that in the 90s when I was there so frequently and my friends and I were running in and out of all those music venues, it was home to me, and it wasn't scary to me. And I don't know, maybe that's naive and foolish.
It was pretty safe. I will say, in 92 or 93, I witnessed this dude get beat so horribly, horribly bad. So stuff like that did happen.
Yeah.
But that was one incident out of, you know, what, 30 years that I've been going down there?
Yeah. I mean, our guitarist, Richard Paul and Rubber Bullet, got the shit beat out of him in Deep Ellum. And I won't comment on who I think that it was, because I think it became quite a big lawsuit of sorts. But that was, yeah, there was some messed up stuff, for sure. That's going to happen anywhere where there's a lot of alcohol and a lot of venues and a lot of it's just going to happen.
Exactly. It could happen at Applebee's.
That's right. Yes. And they'd have more of a drive at Applebee's to get so pissed. But it was quite a scene. And before I was in Rubber Bullet, I ran around and just in and out. I was 20, 21, and ran around in and out of those venues and got to know different people and got kicked out of different places. There's a fun story that Sean Bailey, who works for so many bands and is such an active part of the music scene, but Sean Bailey at the time was kind of the bouncer and the door guy at Trees when I was 20, 21, and I went in, I snuck a beer in, and I had, of course, X's on my hands, and I did what you do is you go in the bathroom, you try to scrub that off your hands, which I did, and I pulled my beer out of my whatever coat bag, whatever I had, and I started drinking it in this pit of people at Trees. And Sean Bailey is standing up on one of these ledges at Trees, shines his big honking flashlight on me and points at me, and I get thrown out. I'm like, what the hell? How did you even see that? And he said, we only serve long necks of that beer. You didn't have a long neck. So, and Sean, you know, ended up like being at my wedding and all kinds of things. And he and I became friends, but that's just one of those things. We were running around that part, and there was so much good original live music happening. And I couldn't get enough of it. I was just being teethed on this stuff. And when Rubber Bullet formed, so did a local record label, Last Beat Records. And Karen Barrett started that with Tammy Thompson. And Tammy did. Karen was a musician in her own right.
Yeah, what was the name of her band? I photographed it for Last Beat.
Oh, did you ask me? Flux?
I can't remember.
Oh, sorry. Karen, and Karen's a dear soul. She had her own music, her own musician, but she started this and funded it and generously funded Last Beat Records and put Tammy in charge, which was who is the right person to put in charge of a musical entity. And Karen came to a Rubber Bullet show, and I remember standing there after Rubber Bullet had played, and I was kind of it was at Trees, and I was kind of in front of the stage, and I had my black backpack, which I constantly had, and she just came and stood by me, and she said, I really want your band on our label. And I did not know who she was. I didn't know anything about it, because Last Beat was getting started as well, and Rubber Bullet was kind of new too. So, but we did ultimately sign with Last Beat, and they were so wildly supportive of the artists that they signed. And it was an all-woman entity. That's not true. There were a couple of men in the studio, because there was Last Beat Studio as well. But overall, the overarching staff at Last Beat Records were women, and really supported bands with females in them. And at that time, that was cool. That was nice.
Well, people loved Last Beat. I remember when I used to review albums for Harder Beat magazine, and every time I'd see the Last Beat logo, I'd be like, "Oh, I gotta review that because I know it's gonna mm-hmm. be good."
Oh, that's cool. Yeah,
they knew the right music.
Yeah, they knew the right music. They had a really premium studio that Karen was generous enough to have built, and that helped. You know, to have good gear to use and good sound and strong engineers. So that was nice. But going back into the scene of Deep Ellum during those days, there was a book. Who's the photographer that did the photo book? Oh my God. I shouldn't have brought it up if I can't think of his name. But he has Earl and I in that book, and it was really cool. And he did an art opening for it, or book signing opening thing. And so many artists from that time came because he had photographed them. And that was just, it was just a nice reminder of a special time in that scene. There were so many artists. There was some crazy stuff because there were,
was it James Bland?
No, it wasn't. Okay, James Bland. Because
he was big 80s Jim, yeah. and mm-hmm. up to mid 90s, shot a lot of music.
I'm an idiot for not remembering this. The book is somewhere in my house. But anyway, but it was just, it was a cool time, special time. There was some ugly stuff at that time because I know that the Dallas Skins were running around those streets for a while, and that came and went, luckily, before I really was down in that part. But that had nothing to do with music. You know, that just was a rebelliousness that a lot of artists, neighborhoods are going to attract. And but there was just so much. There's jazz going on, of course.
Yeah, Sambuca was still down there.
Yeah, Sambuca. Mm-hmm. God, how great is that? So yeah, it was a special time.
Well, so you mentioned all the bands on Last Beat. I know there was Vibralux, mm-hmm. and we talked about Kim already. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned playing with Baboon before, and they were a big part mm-hmm. of Deep Ellum. I mean, what can you tell me about Baboon?
Besides, it was a total blast touring with them. We all became, I feel, we became really good friends. It's hard not to when you spend that much time. And we went out in and out about 30 days at a time with them. And such strong musicians and performers. Andrew Hufstetler is such a strong vocalist, such a strong performer. And them as a group, they were just so one, which is a cool thing to watch a band pull off. It wasn't a band with five musicians. It was a band with one sound, and it was gorgeous.
It was a band with five musicians, and one would wear a horse mask, and then one would pull out a trombone and whistles. And yeah, so I saw them. I shot them at Trees, and Mike, for some reason, decided to do Van Halen's Eruption.
Yeah, that was a normal. Like yeah. he would whip Eruption out on the regular.
And he'd play that, and he'd somehow play it in a way that it seemed like it was his track.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what was beautiful about it.
And it made it look like it was an easy little number to whip out on the guitar.
I reviewed several Baboon albums, and the live one, I remember writing, you know, about how amazing the album was. I said, but there's no way you can capture what they do live. Absolutely. In any way. You have to see them live.
You have to see them live. Yeah. The horse head, the trombone, the white clothing that they all wore with like a black belt. They were just spectacular and are spectacular. I don't know if they still play. Do they?
I don't know if they've had a Baboon reunion or not. I mean, I know there's other projects that they've gone on to.
Yeah. They were spectacular, and we played, we have the 7-inch that's sitting here. We did, Rubber Bullet and Baboon did this split 7-inch that's pretty great.
Oh yeah, I think that's the one I've got.
Yeah, on orange, is that orange vinyl? Yeah, I think it's orange vinyl. And, it's just, I don't know, what those guys were good people, funny, super smart, which is what the bulk of the musicians were at that time. Like just brainy, cerebral, crazy good musicians. And I was so fortunate to have been invited into that circle and into that world. And while Rubber Bullet, while Pinkston was this really cool, pretty entity of my creativity, Rubber Bullet was 100% just this part of my heart and soul because of the way that we were connected to that music scene and the way we were connected with other bands and the way we worked with other bands and just ran into each other out and about and talked shit and hugged each other's necks. It was such a really rich artistic time in my life. And again, I was just so honored to have been pulled in and asked to join the club, so to speak. And Baboon, Spectacular, so many great artists at that time. And the Last Beat Records being such a big part of it and that kind of woman-operated entity. And, you know, One Ton Records was at that time as well, and One Ton did spectacular things with musicians and bands through that same time period. And so it's it's a really cool memory to be able to walk through.
Well, I think what we should do is we should play some Baboon.
I would love that.
Perfect. At this point now, you're starting to transition out of music. Why don't you go ahead and fill us in on that path?
It's kind of similar to not remembering the end of Rubber Bullet. I don't remember the end of music for me. But I do remember a strong desire to do something that that was always a big part of my existence, which was to help families. I know this seems like a weird little pivot, but even with my music and all of the lyrics and all of the things, I was coming from a place that was my family of origin, which was the family that raised me. And there were some good, wonderful, beautiful chapters of my childhood, and there were some problematic things in my childhood. And then as I went into high school, my parents went through this pretty colorful divorce, and that really did something to my psyche. That really did something to my trajectory. And I became very interested in helping teenagers whose parents were divorcing. When music was kind of feeling as though it was kind of organically rapping, again, I mentioned my last show was with Pinkston when I was 4 months pregnant, and I had this amazing baby and was married and started.
And your whole household was music,
yeah,
because you had,
yeah,
Todd was, yeah, in Toadies and you were in Pinkston.
Right, right. And it was the whole household was music. And I thought this might be the time. This might be the time to get into school and to educate myself to become a therapist so that I could help the families of divorce and the families and the kids and the teenagers and the young adults that have struggled in their own skin and in their own lives. And I felt a calling, if you will, to give my heart and soul to that population. And so I went in to educate myself. I had to start all over, bachelor's degree, master's degree, the supervision certification hours, and got to a point where I went into private practice and did exactly what I was hoping I would do, is helping kids of divorce. And I really found that, funny enough, I found that I was working super well with artists who were coming in. We're, you know, artists are empaths most of the time, and which just means that we're packaged with big feels. And so if we have music to put it into, that is kick ass. And here we are at the end of 2023, and I spent this entire year, starting in I think February, writing a book. And that the book that I've written, it should be self-published in January of next year. It has 3, 4, 5 chapters of this Deep Ellum music scene in it, kind of memoir approached, that's been so cathartic to write through all these chapters of my young adult life up till Ruby being born. And it parlays into a self-help book, because it's exactly what I've done. It's been this creative, this musician through my young adult life into a professional. And I've kind of just swooped it all up in one book so that it can help others.
Well, so let's say somebody is listening right now and they're feeling that depression, or, you know, like you and I have both done, you know, going through a divorce.
Yeah.
What should you tell them? What will you tell them?
I think that I feel like while culturally the world can look at divorce and challenged childhoods and quote unquote losses as such big problems, but man, those are really, that's the muscle of your life if you let it. If you can take your darker days and pull them together and decide to find the light in those darker days and the strength and the muscle in those darker days, because those things existed that just got a little overshadowed with the sadness or the fallout. But if you can use your darker days for good, that's powerful creativity. And that's when you're going to create some really cool things. That's going to be when you create some good music, some good painting, some good writing. Don't throw away your own trajectory, or don't feel as though you're doomed because you've had some hiccups along the way. Fucking embrace that. Like, embrace those hiccups, color them, show them, like, pull them out, show them out to everybody. Like, let it be, it's okay. I think the more that we share our darker days, the more we're going to help contribute to better mental health across the board. Because when we feel, if we hear that other people have had struggles, it helps us when we're struggling. And if we feel like we're not alone because people have had the balls and the willingness to admit that they've had some bad days and they didn't do some things so well, if we all could just own our darker days, we would be actively participating in lessening the amount of depression, anxiety, even suicides that exist. I believe that.
Well, why don't we play something? Can you think of a song that maybe is a Texas artist kind of working through their feelings?
Oh, God.
Who should we play next?
Texas artist. Actually, on the Pinkston record, the full length, I have a song, and I don't know what track it is, but it's titled This Time Next Year. And I wrote that while married, but kind of an undertone with it. But there's a subconscious layer in that song that suggests me really questioning where I'm headed, where I'm going. and kind of in the light of where I am as a human on this earth, that song reflects that for sure.
Yeah, that would be great. And I mean, there's nothing wrong with playing more Pinkston. I'd like an all Pinkston show. So let's go ahead and hear that.
Self-promotion.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I think a good place to lead to before we close out the show is, why don't you tell me about some of the current musicians that you appreciate? It seems like there was a time in the 90s that female artists were really kind of developing what they wanted to be, and they've laid the groundwork for people of this current generation. I know that your daughter is a musician.
She is, yeah.
Tell me about that.
Ruby Faye Lewis, she is a musician, and she started a band of her own when she was in eighth grade, Ting Tang Tina, and they played throughout her high school years, and now she's in New York studying photography at Parsons and is doing music again with the other guitarist. She was a guitarist in Ting Tang Tina. The other guitarist has moved there recently, and they're playing together with another kid from Fort Worth, and they're all finding their own sound up there in Bushwick in Brooklyn, and super proud of her. She's just kind of a natural. And as for the current day, I appreciate that accolade of what the 90s musicians did and the females for current.
Well, it's absolutely true. I mean, but you look at the music of the 80s, you've got stuff like Madonna and Cyndi Lauper, and they're developing a strong presence. But it wasn't until the 90s and you started to hear stuff like on Kill Rock Stars label and the stuff that was on Last Beat.
Yeah.
And you start hearing these female musicians who are saying, we want to do it this way. This is us.
That's cool. And, you know, the first person that comes to mind that I adore for just a prowess of different musical styles is Sarah Jaffe. I adore her. And Sarah's been kind enough to even support Ruby, my daughter, when Ruby was going through music in high school. Sarah was a fan of Ruby's, and Ruby, of course, a fan of Sarah's. That kind of attitude, coupled with Sarah's extreme talent, that's a glorious thing to find. And that's just a really cool thing to see, which is someone who is absolutely, like you said, creating her own sound and making her own way. I can't say
enough
about Sarah.
She supports and works with so many people here on the scene.
Yeah.
It's nice to see.
Yeah, very nice. Very refreshing. The song that I would love to hear as an outro of this piece, it would make me happy, is Sarah Jaffe's Clementine.
That's so gorgeous.
It's so beautiful.
That's right. I forget where I first heard that, but I remember the very first time hearing that, and I was like, this is the most beautiful song.
It drives, it's gorgeous. Too. It's got such a rhythm to it. It's so driven. I love it.
Yeah, no, that's a great one. Let's do that.
I
think that is a perfect outro. Well, I appreciate you spending time with us. This was a lot of fun.
A lot of fun.
It was just such a great time in the 90s, seeing all that happen.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you were a part of it.
Me too.
And it was exciting getting to talk about it again.
Same. This is a lot of fun. I appreciate your time, and I appreciate your genuine, heartfelt passion for what it is you do, because that just delivers great products for all of us. So thank you.
Sounds good. All right. Come back next week. Thanks.
Lies, 50, I'm gonna change my mind, change my mind, change my mind. dead.